Hey, it's John Williams, ready for another exciting edition of the Mincing Rascals, a longer version for you today. What do you know? We had more studio time. And boy, did we have a lot to talk about, including an $11 billion city budget, 25,000 teachers, the 2016 World Series, and $1 billion in red light camera fines. And that's all before we went to Trump land. By the way, another bonus track at the end of this edition of the Mincing Rascals with Raja Krishnamurthy, the Chicago area congressman. He was in that congressional hearing when the Republicans stormed into the secure room. It reminds me of a scene from Dr. Strangelove. Raja Krishnamurthy describes what was going on in that meeting and what that whole scene was like at the end of this podcast. Share this podcast with your friends. Give us a good rating if you don't mind, if you think it deserves it. And we always appreciate your feedback. John Williams at WGNRadio.com. Today is Thursday. It's October 24th, 2019. It is 11:03 in the morning. Wow. And hi, this is John Williams, and this is The Mincing Rascals, a weekly podcast we record in the studios of WGN Radio, downtown Chicago. Listen for me weekdays from 1 to 3.
I'm Austin Berg, content director at Illinois Policy Institute and co-author of The New Chicago Way.
I'm Heather Sharon, the managing editor and City Hall reporter for The Daily Line.
And I'm Lisa Donovan with The Chicago Tribune. I write the Spin Politics newsletter.
Eric Zorn could not join us for a sort of snarky introduction of himself. He was supposed to be here. His flight got, I guess, postponed, guys, so Eric couldn't make it. And Steve Bertrand is leading a group of WGN Radio listeners on a tour in Europe. So it'll be the four of us, and I'm glad because the three of you are smarter than the two of them.
Someone needs to pick up the snark slack. Yeah. The snark slack.
Well, let's start. There's so much to talk about. We will spend some time in Trump land today, but there's a lot of Chicago City news, and we'll start with $11.65 billion. That's the Chicago budget, and it's, what, $838 million short. By the way, only 20 countries in the world, according to a story I saw on NBC a few years ago, have larger economies than the Chicago area. Do you want to be mayor? So to bridge that gap, the mayor has a number of clever ideas. When properties change hands, tax richer properties more. It's not that there's more work, but make a more expensive thing for the well-off, like graduated income taxes. That'll raise some millions of dollars, and then we could get the state to pay more for ambulance services, and we could increase the tax on restaurant food and drinks. The mayor's proposing that we increase rideshare taxes in most situations, including a tripling of the tax if you take an Uber or Lyft to the downtown from 78 cents to $3 a ride. And on it goes. What jumps out at you all?
Whenever budget season rolls around, I'm reminded of a line in an S&P report on the state of Illinois. And the line is, Illinois' persistent crisis-like budgeting environment. And it is that way at the state level, at the not the county level so much this year, definitely at the city level. And that is driven by the biggest cost driver, the biggest increase in cost in the city budget is pension debt and debt generally. All the talk yesterday went before Lightfoot was announcing her budget was, how is she going to close the gap? How is she going to close the gap? The $838 million gap. How is that going to be rectified? And the problem is, over the next 4 years, pension payments are going to grow by $1 billion. The gap will reappear immediately next year. So any kind of one-time fix or even small sources of new revenue, like we're talking about congestion charges, will be very quickly eaten up, and we will be right back in this position.
I did mention that she is asking Springfield to, what, give the city the power to change the pension plan, right?
Correct. And that is going to be a big lift in the only a few day fall veto session that starts on Monday. The mayor has her eye on those out-year deficits, which is why she wants the state to change the structure of a Chicago casino, which could potentially make it more attractive for investors and operators. However, you know, I think that Springfield has its own persistent budget crisis, and the fight over the graduated income tax is slowly gearing up. And whether or not they're in the mood to help Mayor Lightfoot, I think, is very much an open question.
Right. She's posting or positioning this as, the legislature should want to help us. She's almost saying if the legislature doesn't, it's their fault. If your property taxes go up, she's going to put the onus on them, with this idea that we, Chicago area, we're 80% of the economy, and that as our fortunes go, so does everybody else's. And so we'll see. It feels like, you know, the governor is saying, look, we'll shop this around, sure. Madigan is not. His folks seem to be lukewarm on it at best, saying, well, we'll see.
Yeah, help is a relative term, right? It's not like they're just pouring a bunch of money in Chicago. It's giving the mayor the power to hike taxes, which is not exactly, you know, like a gift, a great gift that you would want, right? So right. It's interesting. I think what's going to be very interesting to see is I think she is getting completely boxed out by the powers that be now, whether it's the county, whether it's the Democratic Party headed by Madigan, or even Pritzker. I don't think she can expect much of anything from Springfield, and I would prefer if she would ask for things other than the ability to hike taxes. There's other reforms she could ask for as well.
I'll ask you about that in a minute, but what's the remedy in Springfield for the pension crisis?
So what we've proposed as and the Tribune editorial board has endorsed as well, is a constitutional amendment that would allow for changes to future benefits.
Future benefits, not current benefits.
Exactly. So every dollar someone has earned, current retirees wouldn't see a dime slashed from their check, but you would allow for changes to things like retirement ages and that 3% automatic benefit increase that you get every year.
Going forward, but if I'm a person receiving, if I'm paying into, if I'm still working, that would affect me down the road. It would affect my total
It would affect
pension.
The future growth of your pension. But every sort of like, you know, year banked that you've earned and the percentage of payroll that you would get as a pension, all that is protected.
Well, I'm cool with that, not being one of the people that would have their pension undercut
John.
A little bit. But are you one of those people? I mean,
no. But undercut, I mean, you tying it to a cost of living adjustment is not being undercut. Right now you're getting
3% is the cost of living?
3%. A year is way over the cost of living.
That's my point.
We shouldn't even call it a cost of living adjustment. It's an automatic raise.
Right. So let's call it that. I mean, I don't think we're asking too much. Is your point?
Yes,
my point.
Correct.
And by the way, even if we were asking for too much, we don't have it. I mean, I have said this on the radio and on this podcast more than once. I think I would feel a little bad if I was one of the sources of this problem. I would be the fortunate recipient of that deal that the state never should have made or that we should have funded, but doggone it, this is crazy.
Well, of course, the other argument is, of course, these were benefits negotiated and promised, and that it is, you know, bad public policy for governments to make promises and then change the terms of those promises. And let's not forget that Mayor Rahm Emanuel, before he left office, he gave a big speech on how to address the pension crisis and suggested changing this 3% annual raise and was pilloried. Was, you know, Pritzker basically said, you know, he turned into that Mariah Carey meme. I don't know him. I don't know anything about him.
I don't think anyone knew Ron when he was on his way out the door, regardless of the pension.
So, you know, the fact, I think most observers would agree that changing in that is a political non-starter, which means that you want to deal in the realm of the possible. And, you know, I just don't think there's an appetite to change that.
I would like people to apply that same logic to everything CTU is asking for, by the way, what is politically possible versus practical.
My thoughts on this have changed a little bit. Not much, but I mean, the longer they are on strike, the more time you seem to have to focus on certain elements of the negotiation. And class size, to me, does seem to be a fair ask.
Well, I mean, I think class size is something that a lot of parents think about. It's, you know, intense when you think about a kindergarten classroom between 35 and 40 kids. I have, you know, had at 1.2 you know, kids, and that was more than enough for me, let alone 35 to 40. The question is what promises do you make and how do you enforce those promises? And I think that the mayor and CTU remain at odds over whether you should put those staffing requirements and class size limits in the contract.
Correct. If it's a benefit, we're talking about pay and benefits on this. And I CPS, it feels like they should have long ago followed these standards to help their teachers out. Just to have, 25 kids per class, 20 kids per class, it seems like that should be something that the administrative offices should be doing anyway. This shouldn't have to even enter it.
Yeah, how did it get to this, right?
Well, because it's so expensive. You know, it's so expensive to have, you know, five kindergarten classrooms in every school, if that's what it would take. And this has been a place where over the last decade, the school budget has seen sort of, you know, death by a thousand cuts. It was, well, you know, and it was impacted by the fact that the state law changed that prevented CTU from striking over class size issues. So that sort of is part of the CTU's frustration, is that why they're sort of making this, you know, hill to die on stand, because they have no other option.
Well, this is their third strike in 7 years, so I don't think the ability to strike.
Are we really counting the one-day strike
as a strike? Go to school. That was a negotiating tactic. So two major strikes. I mean, this strike is huge. There was a very interesting interview with Stacey Davis Gates and Jesse Sharkey on Chicago Tonight last week. And Paris Schutz asked a very – so Stacey Davis Gates was saying
– Who is she?
You know, she is the vice president of the Chicago Teachers Union, and she was saying
– We've made that clear for the last 10 years that our students deserve class sizes that make sense. 40 students in a kindergarten classroom in the Chatham neighborhood is unacceptable.
Paris Schutz asked a very good journalistic question saying
– How many classes have 40 students or more, would you say, out of all classes K through 12?
You know, off the top of my head, I don't know. But, I mean...
There are 1,300 oversized classrooms right now in the Chicago...
Oversized meaning...
And that's just in the earlier grades.
Yes.
Gates didn't answer the question. Sharkey didn't answer the question. And then they pivoted to say...
One of the things about this strike is that in the last couple of days, I've seen a whole number of grown men and women cry.
The question about oversized classrooms rings hollow with me, because my solution to that is... Let the parents and students leave. Let them choose where they go to school. And yet there is a moratorium bargained by the CTU on new charters. They would never allow for something like a school voucher program where kids could choose what classrooms to attend. You can't talk about out of both sides of your mouth on that. And I don't see any compromise coming from CTU on that point. It seems to all have to come from CPS.
I think there's a very basic thing going on here, too. And that is, there doesn't seem to be any focus, and I'm not sure whose fault that is. One day we hear from the mayor that they're not acting with any kind of urgency. And then what Alderman Ray Lopez, who's not a fan of the mayor's, was saying last night on Chicago Tonight, well, the mayor, the city hasn't called them back to the bargaining table. So we don't seem to be getting a whole lot of answers. And there's a whole lot of discussion out there. And we're part of this, too, as journalists. But there's a whole lot of discussion like, well, we've offered this counter proposal. We've offered this proposal. I'd kind of like to start seeing this paperwork. Is this really what's happening? At a very basic journalistic level, I would like to understand what is truly going on. Well, because nobody's on the same page, and we don't seem to... we've got these 9 points left, and we've got these 4 points left. We're making progress. No, she sent a letter over saying, go back to school. And so now everything's off the... You know, now everything's out the window. We're going to strike for as long as we can.
I mean, CTU has said that the negotiations should be live streamed. They've called for total
great suggestion, by the way. Completely agree with CTU on that.
Yeah, and the mayor has certainly resisted that. And we've, you know, from a journalistic standpoint, we've heard a lot more from the CTU side of negotiations than we have from the CPS side. Today was the first day when the deputy mayor for education and the one of the top CPS officials came out and briefed the press on the negotiations. So that's also sort of different. Tactics that
sure.
you have right there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the CTU has been definitely out there. They've been good about sort of being available. They're on, I don't know when they sleep because they're on late at night and they're on early in the morning sort of making their points. You know, I'm not saying that. I'm saying there's a lack of focus. There seems to be a lack of focus, and that's dribbling out even in the communications.
Yeah.
There just doesn't seem to be sort of, we don't seem to have every day, okay, this is what's been sort of hammered out, this is what's not been hammered out. It just
doesn't
seems
it
to
seem
change.
Like the longer the strike goes on, the more strident and righteous the two sides get. So it's now more, it's less about the students. It's more about what you said about me and the things that you're sort of talking about. We don't even agree upon the things that we disagree upon. It's kind of out of control now. As I'm watching this, I put both sides on a lot on my show, and I don't even know what to ask them because it's sort of hard to keep track of which ball is in the air.
Mm-hmm. And it's tough to say who wears the blame for that. Like, I don't know if the average person who is seeing news every day, they're just looking at TV saying, is school on tomorrow or not? And then a couple of talking points after that. one from CTU saying CPS is being unreasonable, and one from CPS saying there's no more money. Who wears the blame in that situation?
Right, and you have different views even from within the ranks. There's teachers; these are working class folks. I've talked to teachers who are like, "Look, I want to stand up for my rights." But November 1, you know, we don't get a paycheck. We don't, or our regular paycheck, our benefits will be rolled back. I'm nervous about this. I've got to pay rent. I've got to pay my mortgage. I mean, you know, so there that heavily factors.
Who do you think has the upper hand then right now as it drags on?
It's a good question. They all have their talk. They both sides have their talking points.
Yeah, but I wonder who's feeling the most pain, because yeah. I understand how the teachers, those are real people with real mm-hmm. bills to pay.
Absolutely.
But by the same token, the longer this drags on, maybe the longer people will start to, maybe the more points they score in the press.
Right.
Yeah. You know?
No. Yeah. Lightfoot's very popular, but yeah, the longer this goes on, and that's a great point, Lisa. We've gotten several emails this week already from teachers at CPS saying, I don't know if I can go to work. What happens if I do go to work? CPS isn't answering the phone, so I don't know what would happen if I even showed up.
Well, they don't use their email accounts
right.
now, too, right?
And
those
some
are frozen.
Of the, right. So some of them have simply opted out of the union, which is a new right that they have as of the Janus decision last
right.
year. And
yeah.
so now they're not paying any dues to CTU, and they can go and work. I did not expect that to happen so quickly.
Is that a possibility that enough of them would?
That's
be
a huge.
It's
be
a very
so
brave thing to do. It's not like yeah. you can open up a school.
Let's
with
remember
half the
that 94% of union members voted to authorize the strike, so yeah. they are exceedingly united. The other point I would make is that we aren't talking about pay raises, right? We're talking about class sizes, and that's a very different discussion, because I think, for better or for worse, the union has been effective in framing the negotiations as a question of resources for schools as opposed to compensation for themselves. And I think that that has complicated Mayor Lightfoot's effort to say, we've made a fair effort, a fair offer to you, where the teachers are saying, maybe, but we're more concerned with resources.
I think
schools.
Nationally it's playing out like these teachers are insane. You know, because the HuffPost right. has a story about 16% over 5 years or 15% over 3 years, whatever. I don't know that everybody's drilling down into a conversation like this. They don't need to be. But I think that still resonates with a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Is the tide changing on this one?
Well, it's hard to say because we haven't seen polling.
Right.
But
well, there was the Sun-Times poll.
Which is very interesting.
Why? At the beginning, there was one.
I'm very surprised that the mayor's office or CTU hasn't been coming out with, like, flash polls, right? And even if it's, like, push questions or something, you know, stuff that's kind of heavily weighted.
Well,
I've been very surprised not to see
any of that. They're not coming out with it is the key thing. I'm not saying that they have it. I have no insight. But if it doesn't look good either way, they're probably not going to try.
Well, the Sun-Times had a poll that said that if the teachers go on strike, tells you when it was, it will be on the city. They won't be mad at the teachers. I don't know if that's how people still feel. They're still honking support when I'm on the roads and right. I see people go by the signs, but that's not a very scientific poll.
And I don't think the percentages were high. It was like 51%
yeah,
said that it wasn't overwhelming. And I think the mayor probably gets some kind of a, I don't want to say a pass, but I think she gets a bit more of a benefit of the doubt because she's new. She's still carrying this mantle of, like, I'm not an insider. I just want to do the best thing I can. She's not at the table. She said she would be, but you have to be, I think we talked about this last week.
Did.
You have to be very, very careful about entering those kinds of things at the right time. I mean, you know, like, sort of like President Obama coming to the Olympics and saying, pick us, and then they don't pick Chicago. So, I mean, you have to be very careful. That could hurt her. It could show a lack of power if nothing gets done and she shows up.
Well, and more if more candidates like Elizabeth Warren start swinging by and saying, I stand against this, you know, progressive.
Did
mayor,
she help?
Yeah.
Whose cause did she help when Elizabeth Warren came into town shrieking her support of the
shrieking?
Teachers?
I'm here to stand with every one of the people who stand for our children every day.
Shrieking?
That sounds pejorative, doesn't it? Maybe
yes.
it is, but she's. I don't think that she's vested enough in this issue to really have an opinion that matters to me. She was just using the teachers as a prop.
Well, I think, too, this was a little bit of political payback, in my estimation. Lightfoot was interviewed by the New York Times, which had a pretty big story about how Warren seemed to be sort of coming up in polling and fundraising, but she had not captured the imagination or the support of big city mayors and Democratic governors. And Lightfoot kind of she didn't pull any punches. She questioned whether Warren could be somebody who could capture the Midwestern votes that Trump did in 2016, and she just wasn't sure that she could win the thing if she was the nominee. And so I think, you know, I think Warren was feeling a little bit sore about that and thought, okay, you may not support me, but look at all these people who are. Look at this union support and these people cheering around me.
I believe it is time in America to make a new investment in public education. Yeah! And I got a plan for that.
I didn't think of that story. That's a good point. But isn't that kind of petty for a presidential candidate to spend time on and fly in and do that?
I mean, even remember that, having read it, remembered it, and then said, I don't know. And then the teachers throw out the red carpet for her. I guess if Elizabeth Warren wants to stand with him, they don't suffer for that. But
she's a front runner. I mean, why not? She's bringing the spotlight. That's more than welcome. She's bringing the national spotlight. And with that spotlight comes the TV cameras who zoom in and show that this new mayor doesn't have control over things.
Well, one last thing. What about the parents on all of this? I talked to one the other day, but that was more because her son isn't going to get to play in the state finals in soccer. But what are we hearing from the families, from the parents themselves?
Well, I live in a neighborhood with a lot of CPS parents, and I think this is becoming more difficult as the days go by. The kids are home. I think one neighbor has a daycare, so has been able to sort of do some extra duty, but has to watch that because of licensing issues, right?
We had a third grader walk through our offices yesterday. I'm with her dad, you know, just trying to make ends meet on a day-by-day basis.
So I think it's getting difficult. We had a story today in the Tribune about how a lot of these camps that would sort of be help out while the kids are out of school, they're full. Everything's full. So there's not a lot of options. Is it, you know, people might be using up their holiday vacation, of their annual vacation.
Didn't the mayor say, or Janice Jackson told us, you the schools will still be open if you want to bring your kids to school, right?
For a few hours, but not
all day.
And there are no after school.
It's not a daycare,
And there's a very small percentage of kids who have been showing up to the open school building.
Right, which is interesting. What do you guys think explains? I saw that same thing. It was only like 6,000 students or something had showed up at the buildings.
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of concern about supervision for the kids. Right. You know, you've got central office staff essentially being reassigned to watch those schools. And I imagine that some parents are a little bit leery about, you know, sort of in that sort of, you know, not normal situation.
And one of the teachers I talked to said that their school not only has a lot of kids who use public transportation, they use a bus to get in a lot of cases, like a school bus, but also that they serve as sort of a place where kids can catch school buses to other schools in the city. And so I don't think those are available. Those services are available right now to them. And so people who may not have a car that they can zip their kids to school, that's a thing too.
And communication is clearly a problem, as we've been talking about on all of that stuff, which the uncertainty is what is really difficult. One of my close friends, Joe O'Cool, who is a math teacher in Englewood, who was also profiled by Kristen McQuarrie in the Tribune, and he was on a couple of news broadcasts this week because he went to school during the one-day strike in 2016, was expelled from the union, and for going to work. He coaches a chess team there at Earl STEM Academy, and it's been packed every day with new kids because parents just want their kids to go somewhere and learn something. And I'm thinking of all of the kids there who don't have a Mr. O'Cool.
One more thing about Chicago, just we didn't get to this when we were talking about the budget. Any strong feelings about the increase in tax on ride shares going from 78 cents to $3 if you take a solo ride downtown?
I was surprised at how direct the mayor took aim at the ride hailing companies in her speech yesterday.
Yeah, the Tribune story said she reserved her harshest words for in all of this for Uber and Lyft.
She said that they had been given free rein under Mayor Emanuel, which I thought was, you know, just a
shot at his brother.
Exactly.
Right, it was a way for her to sort of back.
But, you know, what's interesting is that we were talking with Alderman Anthony Bill, who has long been a critic of ride hailing and has long been supported by the taxi industry. And he said, look, I have been targeted by the ride hailing companies. I wish the mayor luck because they are going to go and are going full speed ahead to defeat this tax increase. And it's going to be a huge fight. And I think the mayor has opened herself up to criticism that the tax will fall heavily on people who live on the South and the West Side at the same time that she's sort of promising to introduce a new equity-focused framework. Because if you're somebody who lives in Austin, you're not going to be able to get a cab. And if you've got to get downtown to the Loop, you're going to pay a triple tax on what it would cost today. So well, that's an issue.
That's what Uber's line is. I was in Lawndale last weekend for Open House Chicago, and I was talking to three residents were actually chatting about it. They had no sympathy whatsoever for ride hailing. They said that these are, or for the cab companies and the medallion issue, which is a whole separate thing, by the way, but and the following values of those, but no sympathy because they say that these companies are not coming to their community. That they're still sort of there's a transit desert, and that they're part of that. So there's not a lot of sympathy.
I hadn't thought about that. If I'm in Austin and I want to get downtown, and if I'm not taking the CTA, I'm probably not going to find a cab. There's a long wait time for my Lyft to get to my place.
Correct. That was their point, and that sometimes
I believe
it,
that.
Yeah. And I think some people see it as sort of a part. I've heard from some people, I hadn't really considered it. I heard from some other people who said, hey, this is sort of part of what should be part of an environmental issue too, of having all of these cars drive single fares into town. This should be pushed as sort of an environmental thing.
The financial consideration for people on the South and West Side notwithstanding, if we had fewer Uber and Lyft driving around the city, it would be better, right? Environmentally, congestion-wise. Heck, they're going to have that congestion pricing if you bring a car into the city of any stripe from outside of town, maybe in a year or two. They're sure looking at that.
Well, and we learned today that CTA ridership has fallen again, and that is clearly a contributing factor that the city, you know, sort of has to run the public transportation system, but fewer people are choosing it because it's more comfortable perhaps to just, you know, get into a nice car.
I like the CTA. I mean,
take it every day.
By the way, I do too, and sometimes I wait three trains before I can get on. It's so freaking packed. I don't love that. They've got to fix some of these issues.
Absolutely. They need to tie this in with a bigger picture transportation plan.
I totally agree with that.
I know it sounds pie in the sky. Create more lines that get to more parts of the city,
more
east-west.
Yeah. Well, it just needs to be comprehensive instead of a scattershot. So to Heather's point, which I agree with, this is raising, what, $30
million?
$40 million, and you're going to pick a fight with two very, very politically influential companies over $40
million?
There's other ways to get
$800 million.
When you need $800
million. But I'm sorry, it's not a fight worth fighting. I mean, don't you think that there's some... Don't you hate Uber and Lyft cars that stop in the middle of everywhere, including green lights, and just wait or let people out?
I'm a biker, so I very much appreciate that.
By the way,
I'm also sympathetic. Yeah, exactly. They hate me, but I'm sympathetic to the Uber and Lyft drivers.
You are.
I don't know if I agree with this.
By the way, you guys at the Illinois Policy Institute have been studying red light cameras and reported last week. Maybe you saw this man on television. I saw him on Channel 2. Were you on all of the TV stations?
Yeah, most of the
you
local broadcasts.
You were very soundbite friendly, which is
you guys
so
have taught me everything I know.
So important. So I have some of your findings in front of me, but you can do this better than I can. Red light cameras have taken in more than $1 billion since 2008. Billion with a B, you remind me. They're going to be doing this in the suburbs, but in Springfield, they're actually talking about banning red light cameras. Red light cameras bad?
Red light cameras very bad. So the study was the first one to look at, and Tribune has done amazing reporting on red light cameras for the last 5 years.
Yeah.
This was the first one to look at cameras comprehensively outside the city of Chicago, which we thought would be easier, but the state of Illinois keeps no list of where red light cameras are. So we had to go to every single municipality in the state and say, do you have red light cameras? How many? How much did they make? And that's where we got that $1 billion figure. The other reason that I think that popped in the media was because we're seeing in these federal indictments, Safe Speed is involved. And, you know, Cook County Commissioner Tobolsky, his chief of staff, had a contract with Safe Speed. He was literally getting cuts on a per ticket
basis.
This
is part of the federal investigation you're talking about. So the whole system is corrupt because it's in Illinois.
Because, well, I think red light cameras in some sense are going to be inherently a vehicle for corruption just because of the nature of the tool. But yeah, it doesn't help that it's in Illinois.
But what's bad about this? Why red light cameras bad? I mean, corruption notwithstanding.
So so one is corruption.
It's generating revenue, and the revenue is predicated on people breaking the law.
So,
if we have people breaking the law to the tune of $1 billion over 8 years in the state, then maybe we ought to capture $1 billion.
So the reason that red light cameras are becoming way less popular nationally, they're down. The number of communities with red light cameras is down 35% since 2012 across the nation. But in Illinois, it's way up. So the reason being, one, constituents hate them because they feel like they're not being treated fairly. It's the rolling right-hand turn that was totally safe. It's even so. A woman reached out to me saying, I took a right-hand turn to avoid getting hit in the bumper, and I got a $100 ticket for that. People hate them and tell their elected officials that they hate them. They also, there's lots of evidence, especially in Houston, that they increase traffic accidents because people slam on the brakes. So it's actually, instead of a safety benefit, it can actually cause more accidents.
$1 billion.
Per year, it's like almost $130 in these tickets. And Republicans down in Springfield waved a big flag and said they got a big win because they repealed the Illinois franchise tax, which collects about that much per year. And this is just in tickets, tiny $100 or less tickets. And they've proliferated so much throughout the suburbs.
Where's the city or state then heading on that? You say,
take outside the city of Chicago. In 2008, we went from 83 cameras to 2018 being over 300 cameras. So just as many as in the city of Chicago, which has more than any other big city by far, and generating just as much money. So yeah, down in Springfield right now, you have bipartisan legislation saying, these things are bad. Let's ban them. Other states have done that.
And maybe we will, huh?
Maybe we will.
Are any of you sports experts? Are any of you strong opinionators about David Ross being the new Cubs manager?
I'm not thrilled.
Ooh. Yeah. Why are you not thrilled?
I mean, I wasn't a fan of Joe Maddon. I thought he overmanaged and was more impressed by his own brilliance than anything else. But, you know, I'm a big fan of qualified people being hired for jobs that they're qualified. And if somebody could explain to me how David Ross is qualified to be a major league manager, I'm all ears, but I have not heard it.
No previous experience. And I wonder if it's going to be sort of this weird kind of dynamic where, hey, we were colleagues before. Now you're my boss. You can't tell me what to do.
Well, I'll tell you what they say about that, that he did tell them what to do when he was a player. And his resume is pretty good. He doesn't have any managerial experience, but catchers are the thinkers on the baseball field. He's played in pressure situations. He knows this franchise, yada, yada, yada.
As a Cardinals fan, I would be very wary of that language because the Cardinals used it when they hired Mike Matheny, and he was an awful manager.
But it worked in Milwaukee. I mean, I guess at the end of the day, we'll just see how it goes. Listen, we're all going to love this if the Cubs win the World Series in a year or two again.
Unless you're a Sox fan.
I worry that it's more sort of Chicago sports nostalgia. I mean, Mike Ditka won one championship and was set for life. He was sainted. He was, you know, ensconced in the pantheon of Chicago heroes. And it seems to me that the Cubs are like, 2016 was great. What can we do to go back
Glory
to
days.
2016?
Totally.
And that, you know, Chicago has an instinct to sort of want to go back to the good old days because, you know, it was always better back then. And it just seems ill thought out.
I
was rooting for Girardi.
I was too. I agree with you, though, about, and I don't know if it's Chicago's unique to that nostalgic view that you're talking about. Maybe it's because we just don't win that many championships, at least in baseball and in football. Basketball had a nice run. Blackhawks had a nice run. But baseball, we've had two. But, I mean, we haven't had any runs.
Right.
And the Bears have been pathetic since
God was a child.
Well, since Jim McMahon was the quarterback. And they haven't even been necessarily pathetic all the time, but they sure haven't got the job done, right? And I think that our clinging to that 85 team is kind of ridiculous.
I was going to say embarrassing.
It is a little bit. It's, to me, emblematic of how poor we are for good football play in this town.
And I loved the Super Bowl shuffle. I could probably perform it for you here now, but like, let's move on.
Let's move on to This Week in Trump Land.
It's like there's a horse loose in a hospital. Like, I think everything's going to be okay, but I have no idea what's going to happen next. And like, none of you know either.
A couple dozen House Republicans stormed into a closed-door deposition of the Intelligence Committee. Chicago area Congressman Raja Krishnamurthy sits on that committee. He told me this morning that he had no forewarning that the Republicans were coming. Republicans sit on the committee, he reminded me, and many others have access to the proceedings. So this idea that they wanted to see what's going on is a little ridiculous. I also asked Raja if the whistleblower on the Ukraine call should be outed.
Right now, the president is basically threatening retaliation against that whistleblower. And so I'm very concerned about that person basically getting his career ended or her career ended or worse. And in light of that, I'm okay with not knowing that person's identity.
It was a staged tactic. They even had pizza delivered to themselves in the press afterwards.
It's all theatrics. I mean, it's just sort of these continued theatrics. My sense is that this line that the president has given about how the Republicans have been shut out of this and the Democrats are leading the way. Yeah, the Democrats are leading it. It is a bipartisan. It's several committees in there. It's a bipartisan.
Yeah.
I think it's three committees, and it's bipartisan. They're sitting there able to ask questions. But there's sort of this line that I've heard it repeated. I've seen it repeated. I've had lawmakers in D.C. repeat it to me that, well, we don't get access to anything. And this is a wholly unfair to President Trump. And the Republicans are just being shut out of the process. And that's just not true. But if you keep banging it loud enough, maybe it becomes true to people. And, you know, this is all aimed at 2020, right? This is all aimed at this is about negating the 2016 election, trying to dump Trump and trying to sort of sway the 2020 race.
So if Trump was a Democrat, then the Democrats wouldn't be beating the drum this way? That it is about overseeing Trump and not about finding the truth out about the Ukraine situation?
Well, you can compare it to the Benghazi investigation. These were the same rules that were in place for the Benghazi investigation, which was conducted behind closed doors because none other than Trey Gowdy said that's the most effective way to conduct an inquiry like this.
I believe
this.
That it is, by
yes.
the way.
Yes.
This is the way
yes.
the
this
Nixon,
is what,
this
yeah.
is
Nixon
the way Nixon's,
Clinton, all this is the same process.
Yes. And the process is what? Explain, both of you, three of you, what is the value of this kind of process?
Well, it is essentially a grand jury proceeding where you're behind closed doors, you're taking testimony from people involved, and then the prosecutors, which in this case is the Intelligence Committee or the Judiciary Committee, however it shakes out, will then present the best evidence to the entire House, and they will either vote to indict or impeach or not. But, you know, these rules were put in place by John Boehner when he was Speaker of the House, and the Democrats did not stage, you know, walk-ins or sit-ins or anything when this was going on. And there's no doubt in 2020 hindsight that that was a partisan motivated inquiry designed to hurt Secretary of State Clinton at the time. And, you know, the fact that a full quarter of the Republicans who, you know, staged the sit-in yesterday have access to those hearings and have been participating in those hearings and have access to all those documents, I think shows that it's not coming from a pure, like, you know, let's have a good process.
Okay, and I don't know that anybody was fooled by that whole thing anyway. This is it, right? They're attacking the process because the content is damning. And the takeaway from that is, when are some of these Republicans going to say, I'm not going to carry the water for this guy anymore?
We're going to be waiting a while for that, I think. But yeah. do you think this is drawing attention, has effectively drawn attention away from the Bill Taylor testimony?
Yeah.
Because I think it has. Yeah.
Oh,
I mean,
my
it's,
gosh.
If that is corroborated, so my main takeaway there is you have Bill Taylor saying,
European ambassador. No,
right,
the
Ukrainian head of mission.
Right.
Yeah.
And the sitting Ukrainian ambassador, by the way. So he said basically he had knowledge that he thought that the Trump administration was withholding aid to Ukraine in exchange for dirt, an investigation into Joe Biden, and specifically that the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State, and the head of the CIA were trying to meet with President Trump to explain the reasoning why he should release this aid, and they didn't get a meeting. So if you have the executive branch doing that sort of on its own and in a way that's secretive and not really being discussed with other officials, I think that's very significant. And also, that should be able to be corroborated by one of those three people. So Pompeo, the Secretary of Defense, or the head of the CIA. And that's where I think they should go next. Ask those people if that happened.
It was a fascinating real-time description of what the last 6 months have been like. And he described the regular channels through ambassadors in the State Department and then the irregular channels, which include Rudy Giuliani. And he wasn't aware of the existence of the irregular one until he got there. And then he wasn't aware of its influence until all of a sudden the funds were withheld. The most fascinating part of his opening statement, which was leaked, right? I mean, we weren't supposed to see that, as I understand it. The language that Trump and Erdogan would use on the phone call. So meetings are being held beforehand or emails are being exchanged. The president needs to hear this, and then he'll say that. And I don't want to say it was code, but it felt a little bit like that, that if we can get these sentences out of these people, then it will be an agreement. It felt so sneaky.
And his testimony to me feels like the most compelling piece of evidence I've seen in this case. So if they can get
very detailed.
Yeah. So if that is corroborated, I think that's a huge problem.
And he also said that it wasn't just the aid to Ukraine. It was the White House meeting with President Zelensky from Ukraine. It was everything. And I did think it was telling that Ambassador Sondland, who, in Taylor's recounting, told him this today, had his lawyer tell the New York Times, well, I don't recall saying that, which is, if anybody remembers the Iran-Contra hearings, knows that that can be the tell of a scoundrel, or at least somebody who's not telling the full and complete truth.
I'm wondering whether we're going to get corroboration on this, if we're going to get corroboration for that exact reason. Is it going to be, well, I don't recall it going down that way. And of course, we're going to prep the president. Every president is coached, you know, about what to say, so that for diplomatic reasons, you know, I think that there's a whole lot of excuses that
and the lock on the door for them, at least in their defense, is that Sondland did say in that text message or email exchange, there's no quid pro quo. He addressed it specifically and literally in that. You know, it's funny, if you say that, that doesn't change what you did.
And I think to the point about corroboration, I mean, John, I think a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about, I think Eric and I were talking about how, you know, we would want an investigation into when this aid was withheld and getting details on all of that. And John, you basically said everybody's going to stick by the president. And now we have, you know, kind of a squeaky wheel here with Bill Taylor, who is not,
he's not the only one. We had Marie Yovanovitch, who testified under subpoena, and that sort of, their attempt to sort of say we're not going to participate has really crumbled.
So are you going to say that I was saying something right or something wrong?
Well, I think we were expecting that everybody's going to close ranks, but once you have a couple people like that starting to speak out in detail, you have to wonder if even the big dogs like Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, may come out and say some more.
Well, do you think that the president ordered the crashing of that Ukraine call testimony?
Well, didn't he tweet that he said they need to stand up and defend him?
There was reporting that he knew about it and that he encouraged it. I don't know that it is, you know, is a distinction worth a difference.
Yeah, right. Let's talk about Syria for a second, and then we'll wrap this up. The president continues to champion moving forces out, leaving the Kurds to fend for themselves. He's still saying that they were there for 10 years and were only supposed to be there for 30 days. Those statements just aren't true. And his statement that the Kurds are better off is really hard to justify. I wrote, across the broad liescape of this presidency, the things he is saying about our handling of the region are among his most upside-down delusional. I'm speaking about Syria.
I think, obviously, as with any other nuanced issue, his communication about it is going to be very bad. That said, I think what I was, when we were talking about this initially, when this news broke that the troops were going to be pulled out, is I really do think you need to wait to see if Erdogan treats those Kurds like Kurds are treated in Turkey, then this is a massive disaster. If Congress and Trump are able to keep Erdogan at bay, that is a good outcome, in my opinion, and those troops should be brought home. So, I don't want to leap to conclusions about this being the most reckless foreign policy decision ever made.
But what bothers me in the moment is at least his continued characterization of things that just aren't true.
Well, his bipartisan backlash over him pulling these troops out suddenly after a Sunday night phone call. We're gonna leave this stretch of Syria, and the bipartisan backlash smacks of like a seventh grader getting caught, you know, stealing the candy bar. Well, it's just not very presidential, professional. It just comes across as desperate, and I'm still trying to convince you. You've condemned me for doing something. I'm still trying to convince you that I did the right thing.
To his credit, he stands by. Boy, when Donald Trump does something, he stands by it, doesn't he? He does not back down.
There are people who give him credit too for being out in the open. At least he's open about this stuff. There's nothing hidden. supposedly.
You know what it reminds me of, though, when you're watching a football game or a basketball game and the analysts always seem to know what the coaches should be doing, and then you always say, well, then why don't you put the analysts in and let them just go, hey, you got to do the this or that. And Trump sort of governs that way. He goes, hey, everybody said we got to get people out of here. Let's get them out of there.
So Dan Dreiser has a great thread where he recounts all of the times that the president's staff treats him like a toddler. It's a hashtag toddler in chief. And he reminds me of when I had a toddler, and when you say, you know, did you break that? And they insist they did not, even though you saw them with your own eyes break it. And at some point, you start to doubt your own ability to, you know, accurately understand the reality around you.
We didn't even talk about Facebook. Maybe we will next week. I was very interested in some of the things that Mark Zuckerberg had to defend and talk about this
week. I cannot
week.
Defend his haircut.
My wife and I were looking at that, and she goes, what happened? I think he's going bald, and he's just combing it into a real short.
There's a nice sheen going on.
I know. Yeah. Why doesn't he just get plugs?
If I had $1 billion, I would have a much better haircut, even if I were a dude.
Heather Sharon, thank you for coming in. Lisa Donovan, and let me see if I can get this right. Austinberg, thank you for coming in as well. I'm John Williams. The Mincing Rascals are produced by Elif Garris. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.
I think it was an appalling display. Basically, we had about 30 House Republicans, mainly from the Freedom Caucus, barge in just as actually Republican and Democratic members of the Intel Committee and others were about to start questioning the witness of the day. And they started screaming and shouting. And basically, we had to adjourn until much later in the day because of this attempt to basically shut down the proceedings by the House Republicans.
What they seem to be after is transparency. Can you comment on that? I mean, they don't like the fact that they don't seem to have access to the process.
Well, that's inaccurate. They actually have about 40 members of the House Republican Caucus who are involved in these closed-door proceedings. They've been able to question the witnesses for exactly the same time as the Democrats. They can ask about any topic, and they get the opening statements. Not only that, but any member of the House Republican Caucus can examine the transcripts of the proceedings. The reason why right now they're in a closed-door setting is because we're kind of in the fact-finding part of the inquiry, where we don't want witnesses to align their testimony with each other. We want to make sure we just hear their recitation of the facts. That being said, within a short period of time, maybe even later this month, we're going to go to open setting or to open proceedings and publish transcripts. So I think that should allow the public to have maximum transparency into what's going on. But I got to say, John, what happened yesterday was completely unacceptable. Basically, they brought their electronic devices into a secure facility where we have our state secrets literally being stored in the SCIF.
My understanding was those were confiscated, though, right? They did turn those in.
At the very end. But that's just wrong. It looks like what they were really trying to do is to prevent the witness from testifying, especially on the heels of Bill Taylor testifying the day before, who provided extremely disturbing testimony corroborating Mick Mulvaney's statement last week that, you know, essentially military assistance was conditioned on a political investigation that would benefit Donald Trump.
Ronald McDonald, the GOP chairwoman, this is the spokesperson for the GOP, has tweeted this morning, enough is enough. The lies, the secret hearings, and the selective leaks have gone on far too long.
They are trying to deflect attention from the substance of the allegations. You know, almost 100 members of the House now are involved in these closed-door proceedings, 40 Republicans, 60 Democrats. Most people have access to the transcripts, and now it's going to go into an open setting. But again, I think that we want to hear from them about the substance of the allegations. I'm trying to withhold judgment until the end of the inquiry as to, you know, what we should do next. But the way that they're conducting themselves is really is not in line with what I believe the American people want to see in these proceedings, which is more decorum and as orderly a process as possible.
Congressman, I read the opening statement by Mr. Taylor, and it was fascinating. Can you comment on your interpretation of what he either released in that statement or what else he said behind closed doors?
I can't comment on the specific testimony yet, but the opening statement, which he did confirm, is devastating in terms of its corroboration of the whistleblower complaint. I just want to set the scene for a moment, John. Ambassador Taylor is a 50-year career public servant. He's apolitical. He has voted recently for Republicans, but he's a Vietnam veteran, and he's a West Point graduate. And he came at great expense to himself. He flew himself from the Ukraine here to Washington, D.C., because he's currently serving in the Ukraine as our ambassador. And he's risking his career because he wanted to tell the truth and he wanted to set the record straight about what's going on in Ukraine, which he said in his opening statement has been kind of at the forefront of his interests from a foreign policy standpoint. And he basically said that military assistance was conditioned on a political investigation of the president's domestic political rivals. You know, he basically said it was a quid pro quo as far as his testimony is concerned. So this is very, very disturbing.
Should we ever know who the whistleblower is?
At first, I thought that, well, let me put it this way. Right now, the president is basically threatening retaliation against that whistleblower. And so I'm very concerned about that person basically getting his career ended or her career ended or worse. And in light of that, I'm okay with not knowing that person's identity because we have to protect the whistleblower system. The American people want to hear from rank and file people who are witness to wrongdoing in our government and can come forward and report accordingly.
Did you get a heads up that the Republicans were going to storm that meeting? Obviously, it was coordinated. You must have known they were coming.
I personally did not know. I don't know if anybody else did. But essentially, they came in en masse, and I was just sitting down. I was drinking my second cup of coffee for the day. It's just something that boggles the mind. It's just completely unacceptable from my standpoint and from a lot of people's standpoints.